This year's summer solstice is almost upon us. Wednesday is the longest day of the year in 2012 in terms of daylight. But how can more or less daylight affect our sleep? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest today is neurologist Dr. Eric Dykin, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa. We'll also find out about new sleep research, including a new UI study on restless leg syndrome, two new studies that link sleep apnea with cancer, the health benefits of couples sleeping in the same bed, also sleepwalking. A man who claims he was sleepwalking when he tried to rob a woman at knife point. What keeps you awake at night? You can join our discussion after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour we're catching up on the latest in sleep research and news with Dr. Eric Dykin, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa. He's a neurologist and joins us several times a year to catch up on our sleep news and research. As previously mentioned, Dr. Dykin, welcome. Thank you for coming into our studio again.
Thanks, Ben.
This is always a popular hour for people to share their problems with sleep to see if there is any advice the doctor can give that may lead to a more restful night of sleep. Perhaps you've had an unusual experience. We'll be talking about somnambulism a little bit later, some case of that in the news, sleepwalking. Perhaps you have a case of that. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Doctor, if we could start off by, referencing the season that we're in, Wednesday, this coming Wednesday, June 20th at 7.08 p.m. Eastern, well, it would be 6.08 Eastern, our time, will mark this year's summer solstice. That's the exact time the sun is the farthest north in the sky, directly above the Tropic of Cancer. About 16 hours of daylight right now. Excuse me. How does daylight regulate our sleep?
Well, you know, it's sort of an adapting kind of a thing, and a lot of people have some theories about that. But in the old days, our forefathers and mothers, if they were active during the bright sunlight, they could gather crops and go hunting, and the survival was great. Then at night, when it was dark and it was dangerous and the things that were out there that could eat you and you couldn't see the crops to gather them anyway, it was naturally an advantage to have a restorative time, a recovery period, that was sleeping at night. So through the eyes, there are receptors in the back of the eyes that note this, and we call the sun one of the greatest Zeitgebers or time cues for the biologic clock. So that when it's bright sunlight, it reduces certain elements and hormones in the body. Melatonin is the one we've all heard of. And then as it starts to get dark, there's a disinhibition. Melatonin starts to rise and tells the body naturally, holistically, if you will, it's time to go to sleep. So the more daylight, the more awake you are, mm-hmm. and the less daylight, the more sleepy you are. And there can be problems with that.
Does it follow then at this time of year when there is so much daylight that you have more people with problems of insomnia?
Yeah. And in fact, what we did, we went to the blind factory. They had this cute little girl who was trying to sell blinds. So we redid our blinds. And we bought these, not blackout, but pretty much dark out for the bedrooms because I sleep fine. But my kids, my wife, they don't handle the bright sunlight coming in very well. And over the past many years, it was a good investment. So we actually have these blackout or dark out blinds that they put in for us just about a month ago. And in the morning, that bright sunlight doesn't come in through the shades like they used to and disrupt their early morning sleep. So, yeah, it really can. Some of us are more sensitive than others. It doesn't bother me with the dink, but it does bother my family. They're very sensitive to it. So there are a lot of things you can do, like, you know, try to get your sleep in a nice dark room with good shades.
Before we move on, tell us about a new restless leg study you're starting up here, I understand, at the University of Iowa. What is restless leg syndrome, and what are you looking at in particular with a new study?
Well, actually, it's a clinical diagnosis that's defined by the acronym URGE, the urge to move your legs if you have it, it's usually worse at rest. You are rest. G, if you get up and go, G, urge, it makes your leg feel better. And E, it's worse in the evening. So it's a sleep-related problem. When you lay down at night, your legs just go absolutely creepy crawler crazy. So that's restless leg syndrome. And I got it when I fly. It's really irritating. And some medicines work really well for it. And there's a new medicine that we're going to try out in a double-blind placebo treatment versus non-treatment study. And people with this urge syndrome that I just described are open to come to it. But the negative elements is if you've been on good medicines that have helped you, we want you off all your medicines. And we want to see if in a blinded way being on the medicine will help you and compare it to thousands of other people and see if this is a good medicine.
Okay, Dr. Dykin with us of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa. What keeps you awake at night? You can share your sleep problem or your question with us this hour, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, or email Facebook. Iowa Public Radio is also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk.
Ooh, should I give you that number?
Yes. This is for the restless leg study. How can people find out more about that?
Yeah, Jerry Searin is our research coordinator. Make sure you call this number, 319-356-8744, 319-356-8744. Ask for Jerry.
Okay. Interestingly, in the news, there's always some sleepwalking, somnambulation, is that what
you're talking about? Yeah, sleepwalking's easier.
Sleepwalking's easier. There we go. In the news lately, a man who police say admitted that he tried to rob a woman at knife point at a Connecticut casino is planning this as a medical defense. He claims he was sleepwalking when he robbed the woman at knife point. The 27-year-old suspect, Winston Riley, was arrested March 18th. A woman told police Riley had flashed a large knife, tried to grab her purse while the two were alone in the parking garage elevator at the casino. Riley's side of the story, he says he was awakened by the woman when she ran away in confusion and fright. Well, it's well documented, Doctor. You've talked in previous programs. People can do all kinds of things when they're sleepwalking, walking, eating, watching TV, having sex, even committing murder. According to the Scientific American, in 1846, Albert Turrell was acquitted of murder of Maria Bickford, acquitted because he was sleepwalking. So this sounds like a real stretch for a defense when you hear it, but is it possible?
Yeah, and oftentimes the people who are acquitted, it's because they don't have a good rebuttal expert, and they'll get somebody who really needs to make their name and fame, in my opinion, with some of the forensics, sleep medicine, if you will. And I've seen some strange things, but usually a directed behavior where a person can pick up a knife and put it to someone's throat. Again, there was the famous issue where there was a rich wife and the husband lived with some of that money. And he actually stabbed his wife 30, 40 sometimes, drug her body across the swimming pool, held her head underwater for 15 minutes as the neighbors watched through windows. Then he cleaned up afterwards. And my wife said, when she watched, I think, Richard Toupin talk about the final results of that, the technician who was responsible for doing the sleep studies on the fella that they said had sleepwalking broke down on stage and was told by the director of that laboratory to, quote-unquote, cook the books. So I get a little bit worried about what Meir Krieger at the University of Connecticut called the Twinkie defense. We can all Google. It used to be seizures. And, the reason I did it is having a seizure or I was on drugs or whatever it might have been. But it is now a defense, a last-minute defense. And I've actually had patients who have been caught in lies by a state-appointed psychiatrist, and then they just fessed up. So a good sociopath knows how to use the internet, they know how to read the papers, and sometimes the same qualities that makes a successful CEO, physician, ruler of a country can sometimes, in the wrong hands, make an unsuccessful guy with a knife trying to rob, as he said in the article, just needed some money.
Mm. We all know that sleepwalking, sleep talking is very common, especially among the young, among teens. How do we know when sleepwalking would be problematic, when a parent should worry about it, consult someone, because we know it can lead to dangerous situations. We had right here in Iowa, I believe, a young man die sleepwalking and being run over, actually.
Yeah, Mr. Allgood, many years ago, and his mother's become a big advocate for sleep disorder medicine. So he died, but not in vain. A lot of people are made aware of what otherwise would be almost a sort of a silly, a funny kind of an event. But again, Anna Freud looked at many of these parasomnias, these sleepwalking-like events, these behaviors that are associated normally with sleep. And young children, again, especially before the age of 15, may act out with night terrors, nightmares, sleepwalking. And if you sleepwalk in front of a truck, as Jared did, that'll be the last thing you ever did. And that's an unusual amount of sleepwalking. But when the child starts to walk out of the room, fall down the stairs, and it's excessively frequent, then that's when I would see a sleep expert. And an awful lot of times, only counseling and on occasion medications can help reduce this tendency to walk during this period of time. And then oftentimes they outgrow the habit as they enter adulthood.
Join our conversation, Dr. Eric Dykin, director of the Sleep Disorder Center at the University of Iowa. Share your sleep problem or question, 1-866-780-9100. Here's an email sent to rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Doctor, my 9-year-old grandson is afraid to go to sleep. 2 weeks ago, he had a grand mal seizure. Upon wakening in the morning, he remembers having a nightmare about a shadow man as he awoke. He is now afraid he will have another nightmare and seizure. What is it about sleep that causes nightmares and seizures? Is there a connection between the two?
Well, nightmares are normal. Any of us under stress can have a nightmare, and that's like the post-traumatic stress almost. You often have a nightmare that approximates whatever the stress you had during the day. Sometimes. It's not 100%, of course, but we've all experienced that. Now, seizures in sleep, though, are not an unusual thing, especially among people with frequent seizures or epileptics. And a good friend of mine, Beth Mallow, who's the world expert at Vanderbilt, in my opinion, on seizures in sleep, notes that seizures and interictal or brainwave discharges that predispose to seizures are often more frequent in the first third of the night out of what we call N2 sleep. And that's due to a phenomena of what we call spindles that are generated by a certain part of the brain called the reticular nucleus. And it can often generate a rhythmicity that will take normalcy in a person prone to seizures to have their rhythmic normal spindles generate into a seizure. So it's
there is a connection.
There is a connection. It most certainly is. In this child's case, it's just serendipity. It's just too bad he had the nightmare of the night. He had a seizure, and it's like Pavlov's steak and the bell. He's going to associate these two and be afraid of one because this smart kid is going to say, if I have that nightmare again, and then I'm afraid to go to sleep. What I do is I decondition, and sometimes you need an expert psychologist or a sleep expert, a pediatrician, who can take the child, institute cognitive behavioral therapeutic interventions, progressive relaxation therapies, self-hypnosis, so that this child can decondition and not be afraid to go to sleep. Just like Pavlov's steak and the bell with a dog, if you present a steak and a bell 1,000 times, get rid of the bell, the steak, and just ring the bell, the dog's going to slobber. And he's going to do that every time until you decondition. So I think the child had an association between the two and is afraid. Now, sometimes, though, little seizures can mimic hallucination that are sleep-like, and maybe that hallucination was actually what we call the aura or the partial simple seizure. But I would have that assistance of a good sleep expert with a good pediatric epileptologist.
Okay. Laura, in an email to rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, has a related question. Laura writes, I have had night terrors for the past 10 years. In my reading about night terrors, it is a disorder that commonly affects children. I am an adult affected by this disorder and would like to know if there are any effective treatments for night terrors besides overall stress reduction and good sleep hygiene habits.
Yeah, night terrors, as Anna Freud said, she based this on the psychological development we normally go through in Piagetian terms, all those big names. that I learned in medical school. But we usually outgrow the tendency to have night terrors by the time we're adults. So it's very unusual. And when I've ever seen a night terror in an adult, I do an overnight sleep study. That's one of the justifications. There are 95 specific differential diagnostic categories of things we see in sleep. Only four need a sleep study, a great big expensive study. But I would be, you know, I'm from Missouri, show me kind of thing. I'd want to see what she's really doing because that's pretty unusual. See if she really does have elements that suggest a night terror out of deep non-REM, what we call stage three or slow wave sleep, or if she really has something like sleep apnea, where she gets low oxygen, she becomes confused, gets low oxygen to the brain, and you can wake up screaming, yelling, and I've seen people with bad apnea just shoot out of bed because that is unusual. And in her case, seeing's believing. I do a sleep study and look at really carefully about sleep apnea because wouldn't want her on a sedating medicine that would defeat that arousal phenomena, which may be evidenced as a night terror. I think that's what happened to Jerry Garcia, the great guitar player for Grateful Dead, went into the hospital for heroin withdrawal. They put him on a sedative, and he never woke up, died of a heart attack in his sleep. So don't want to bury mistakes. I'd go see a sleep expert with that one prior to taking any medicines.
1-866-780-9100 to talk to Dr. Eric Dykin of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa this hour. Let's go to Ames, where Ben is. Hi, Ben.
Hey.
Hey, do you have a sleep problem or a question?
Actually, I just wanted to say that I have sleep apnea, and I just wanted to let the viewers know, or the listeners, that they think they should, if they think they have sleep apnea, they should definitely get checked out. I waited a long time, like at least a year, and I regret waiting, and I'm really happy with having gotten checked out.
So you checked out, you had sleep apnea.
Sleep apnea.
If you could turn down your radio, please, Ben, there in Ames. You were sleeping poorly and you were hesitant. Dr. Dykin, this is something that happens a lot to people. They don't want to hear the diagnosis because they know usually that involves a CPAP machine, right?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, you know, I was diagnosed 12 to 15 years ago, lost 40 to 50 pounds, was treated with positional therapy, which is a very serious therapy if you do it right. Then I gained my weight right back and woke up with blindness in my right eye. And I'm pretty angry about the whole thing. And I've got glaucoma, it appears, but I woke up with it. And I know that untreated apnea will increase intrathoracic and intracranial and intraoptic pressures in the eye. And one of our world experts in ophthalmology, Dr. Hayray, has a theory about visual loss in apnea. And what my doctor tells me, I'm not getting that vision back, but I don't want it to get any worse. So my thought is I agree with what he says. Preventive medicine, low oxygen's a bad thing. And so I've learned my lesson. I got a new machine, and I'll tell you, my kids like it. They're going to go on vacation with me. They'll put up with the snoring, and the machine's quiet.
You actually had your kids refuse to go on vacation because you were snoring so much.
So we're at Disney, and I needed the facilities at 2 in the morning, and I usually share the bed with my son. My wife shares with my daughter, and I tripped over this lump in the bathroom, and it was my son. I said, "What are you doing laying on the floor in the bathroom?" A little blanket on him. He says, "Dad, the snoring. I can't stand this." So now he goes, "So we're getting ready for a vacation, and I'm bringing the CPAP."
Okay. Ben, thank you for sharing your experience with sleep apnea today. Ben, in Ames, dialed 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to this email. Bill in Bettendorf wants to know why the U.S. doesn't allow a cold laser treatment to remove the soft tissue in the back of the throat. He has sleep apnea and uses a CPAP. And from what he understands, if that tissue were removed, it would solve the problem. He has heard they allow the treatment in Canada. Tell us what he's talking about, please.
Oh, they allow that treatment, laser-assisted uvular palatoplasty, but it's primarily for the treatment of snoring. Across the board, the big surgery, the uvular palatopharyngoplasty, all that Latin term for the stuff in the back of your throat that gets in the way of your breather, well, it doesn't work very well, 15 to 40% at the best in the studies, I think, that were done in Minnesota many, many years ago. So our ears, nose, and throat people here at the university are, I think, number two in the world. And they will let you fail CPAP before they cut to cure. Not a very good success rate because the collapse in sleep apnea can be anywhere from the tip of the nose down to the lung bed. So there's multiple areas, not just the back of the throat. And the laser hurts like stink. They have to put it in phases because they don't want to cause too many pain fibers to go crazy. It's a great thing for snoring because it gets rid of the floppy tissue for snoring, but it is miserable across the board for sleep apnea. So it's expensive. It hurts like crazy. It doesn't work. Those are three things that do not endear you to your physician. So, yeah, it's out of pocket in the United States because it's such a poor return on the investment. The other thing it can do, it's like 9/11. Take out the middle floor, the whole building collapses. It can cause velopharyngeal insufficiency in many subgroups of patients. It can make things worse. It can make a lot more floppiness. And if you're a singer, it can make you sing like Donald Duck. So you got to be careful. It can change the way you sing and speak to more nasal tones. So not without side effect.
Okay, we have a couple more minutes, Doctor, but we have to take a break halfway through our hour. But related news, a lot of sleep research news coming out or shared at the 2012 Associated Professional Sleep Society's gathering that finished up last week in Boston. Here's one of the things that was shared there, the two new studies having found that people with sleep apnea, this, again, sleep apnea, this common disorder that causes snoring, fatigue, dangerous pauses in breathing at night, people with apnea have a higher risk of cancer. It marks the first time that sleep apnea has been linked to cancer in humans. So this is a continuum that we've been hearing for years and years, health risks continually mounting and associated with sleep apnea.
Well, you know, like my mom says, she's no doctor, but she had six kids. She just hears about apnea. She says, well, low oxygen to every cell in your body. That just can't be good. And as you say, the common sense is that it's a bad thing. The specific problems, we're learning more and more. And one of these studies actually came from the great Terry Young studies, a cohort study in Wisconsin. And cohort means that they do a whole bunch of studies on thousands of people and they follow them over many, many years and they see where the problems then arise in people who aren't treated with sleep apnea. And in their study, and they've done so much good work, they found that people with severe sleep apnea had five times the rate of dying from cancer as people without the disorder. Now, that's with apnea probably even prior to the study. And the other study, the one from Spain, they followed people without apnea who then without any cancer and that had the most severe forms of apnea, and they found that those people with severe apnea had 65% greater risk of feeling any kind of cancer. So the oxidants, the pathologies, the dust that settles after not breathing for a long period, it may actually increase the risk for having cancer, but these are comorbidities. Cause and effect, you can't just say.
Okay, Dr. Eric Dykin with us. He'll continue to stay hang on and be with us in the second half hour. Director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa. He's with us in our studio this hour to talk about the latest in sleep research and news, also to react to, give perhaps some advice on your sleep problem or answer your sleep question. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, give us a tweet at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. When we come back, we'll have him tackle Carol's question from Cedar Falls. She has restless leg syndrome, and she's noticed some dietary connection, possibly. We'll see. She asks if there's any studies connecting restless leg syndrome with dietary diet. That's when we come back. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're catching up on the latest in sleep research. So nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and we're catching up on a state that we spend roughly a third of our lives in. It's very important. It determines how well the other two-thirds of our lives, how we feel about ourselves, how we operate. Of course, we're talking about sleep, catching up on the latest sleep research and news, fielding your questions with Dr. Eric Dykin, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa, 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org, our email. Give us a tweet at IPR Talk. We're also on Facebook. Let's go right to the phones, if we could. Dr. Dykin, Rick is joining us from Iowa City. Hi, Rick. You're on the air. Go ahead, sir.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I was wondering if the CPAP machine is such a helpful device, why aren't they like over-the-counter so we can just go ahead and try it on our own and see if they're beneficial? Why do we have to go through a doctor or like a sleep study overnight, that kind of stuff?
Okay. Reasonable question. A good question. Thank you, Rick.
Well, real expensive is one. Number two is it's not without potential side effect. And if it's not at the right pressure setting, you won't wear it. If it's too high, it's a small hurricane in the back of the face. If it's too low, it could be potentially life-threatening. And two of the life-threatening ones, we even published one of our patients, very sick fellow who was seen after having a coronary artery bypass graft in post-op period by the nurses to have apneas at night. So as an inpatient, we did a sleep study, and he had bad apnea, started a CPAP that night, and he quickly went into the deeper stage of sleep, REM sleep, because he hadn't been there so long, and you don't arouse. Your arousal phenomena, just like Jerry Garcia being on the medicines over there in the hospital when he was going through withdrawals, he didn't wake up, and he went into coma, hypoxemic coma, and my technician actually got an award for this. We presented it at the Salk Institute. He had to be mouth-to-mouth. He would have died because another patient we had who went into hypoxemic coma, very sick person, undertreated, went into the coma, and I was not allowed to intervene. The wife gave me permission to monitor his sleep, but would not allow. This was part of an IRB approved. He had come in for palliative care to die with an end-stage horrific health problem. And he went into hypoxemic coma and died of a heart attack right there. So you've got to be careful with this. People with congestive heart failure, CPAP, if they have what we call complex apnea, it actually will increase the pressure, reduce venous return, the blood flow return from this other part of the body, and the patients are at higher risk of dying from CPAP. And that's the famous CanPAP study that was actually halted when they said the same thing you said. Why not just give them a try? Everybody with failure has some kind of obstruction at a high percentage, up to 75%, central, Shane-Stokes, or mixed, what we call complex apnea. And those people with the complex apnea were dying from CPAP. So this isn't just a thing you get over the counter for $1,500 to $2,000, stick on your face, put it at a setting without potential side effect.
Michael is joining us from Coralville, also an apnea-related question, I believe. Michael, welcome to our program.
Thank you. I have a CPAP machine, which I really love for the benefits I've been getting. I see advertisements from dentists to do like a dental plate or something they put in there to sleep with. Are those effective?
Yeah. In fact, we probably underutilize them. And according to the American Academy of Sleep Medicine constructs and parameters, if you have mild to moderate sleep apnea, that is, you stop breathing less than or equal to 30 times per hour when you sleep with apnea, you might be a candidate for an oral device. I think you use the TAP something system. And one of our dentists at the University of Iowa, well, actually two of them, two groups of them, can actually see if you're a candidate for this treatment. And classically, it's used for people with very small jaws, microgonathia, I think they call that. And if you remember young Frankenstein, Marty Feldman, he had Crouzon's. And there's a lot of people with these congenital genetic syndromes where they have very small jaws. And that's the kind of group where if you pull the jaw forward, it opens up a relatively reduced anterior airway space. So people with small jaws, if you see the expert and you stop breathing less than 30, you might be a candidate for the oral device.
So who makes that determination? Could it be your dentist would make that determination, or would it need to be a sleep expert?
It would be the same thing, a sleep expert who's a dentist. So sleep medicine is a branch of medicine in its infancy, but it's multidisciplinary. And there are societies of sleep dentists who can look at you. And they can take a look at your face, and they're familiar with the machine, and if you're a candidate. So we do have that here at the university. We have a sleep expert who is a dentist. Take a look at you, see if you're a candidate for it or not, especially if you reach those parameters of severity.
We will throw this out at the end of the hour as well, the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa. For your information, the number to reach that center is 319-356-3813, 356-3813, area code 319. Questions about apnea keep coming in. My husband has been diagnosed with both types of sleep apnea, writes Susan in her email. He's on a BiPAP machine. He only wears it for 6 of his 8 hours of sleep and says he has not gotten a good night's sleep since he was placed on it 5 months ago. Is this dangerous, writes Susan? What can be done to make him more comfortable?
Well, one of the things maybe this is only 6 of the 8 hours of sleep. So if you're wearing CPAP, you need to use it whenever you sleep, all the time you sleep. So that hypoxemia to the brain, the signs and symptoms of having too low oxygen to every cell in your body can be multitudinal, all sorts of complaints, et cetera. So if you're not wearing it all the time, well, that would be expected. Yes, and we know that untreated sleep apnea, you need oxygen to keep alive, you need sleep, and you need food. So oxygen's a must, and that low oxygen, if you have an apnea hypopnea index, which means you stop breathing 20 or more times per hour on average, the great Terry Young, who we talked about a little bit earlier, some of those cohort studies have shown if you are not treated, you have a higher risk of having ischemic stroke, which is the number 4 cause of death in the United States, number 2 cause of death in the world. Cardiac dysrhythmia is evidenced by atrial fibrillation, and also hypertension, which is one of the big comorbidities for vascular disease and death in the world. So, yeah, it's a bad thing. And what I would do is see a group that has great technologists that can introduce you to a comfortable CPAP mask like I did. And at the University of Iowa, Don McKinney is our CPAP expert technician. That's all he does. And there are 200 different interfaces. It is no small task getting a comfortable machine, and you really need an expert who does nothing but look at patients and can afford them a comfortable machine. Because if it's not comfortable, I did that after a year. Threw mine up against the wall, then I hired Don.
Mm. Carol from Cedar Falls emails us. She says, I know without a doubt that I have restless leg syndrome when I have not had enough milk in my diet. Once I get back on milk, Carol writes, the RLS, the restless leg syndrome, goes away. Has there been any study showing connecting restless leg syndrome with diet?
Yeah, there's a lot of different things that can exacerbate caffeine, central nervous system stimulants, sleep deprivation. And then as you imply, for not drinking milk, it might even be a dietary-related element. You know, this is with everybody getting ready for a vacation and going out to the beaches, et cetera, starvation. And as you, is implicit, if you're not drinking the milk, you're not having other things in your diet, ketosis, which you get when you start not eating and you have that terrible breath, halitosis, you know, 24 hours a day. That's why I carry around my Tic Tacs. It implies there's something else that you're doing. And yeah, there's a lot of things you can do to exacerbate the underlying problems with restless leg syndrome. So, you know, like I've said before, it's often good to sit down with an expert. The history and physical is what we base medicine on, and to talk about those issues. But, you know, anecdotally, you see it. You know there's a cause and effect relationship. Keep drinking the milk, and it's good for your bones. And avoid osteoporosis and apnea.
1-866-780-9100. Our sleep doctor with us this hour, Dr. Eric Dykin of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa. Chris joins us from Ames. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Yes, I have a problem for my brother-in-law has a problem where he can't sleep without the TV on, so he has to have the TV on while he's sleeping. And I don't think he's getting enough good sleep. Like he's had this since he was a kid. And he can't sleep without the TV being on the background music. He says it's background music for him, so he doesn't really, he says that he can't sleep through it, and he can't sleep without it. But he still sleeps during the day also, so I don't believe, like, he's getting good sleep, and I don't know how to help him out.
Thanks, Chris, in Ames.
Yeah, we have a world-famous neuropsychologist, and we were talking about sleep hygiene. And you allude to the fact that sleeping with the TV on, we've been told that's a bad thing. Well, for him, and he's what he told me years ago, I've slept with the TV on ever since I was a kid, and it's mother's milk. If I don't have the TV on, I cannot get to sleep. So he's positively conditioned, maybe not the rest of the people in his family to that TV blaring, et cetera, but he is used it to help him as an element of good hygiene, sort of a paradox. And as such, if your brother has been doing that forever, but he's still having daytime sleepiness, there's something else going on. And, you know, as I mentioned, there are 95 differential diagnostic categories in our International Classification of Sleep Disorder Medicine, second edition, published again in 2005. Pick it up. Read it someday. Lots of things. But to know all those things, sometimes you need to start with your general practitioner, get that history and physical, have them do a full medical review, and see which of these 95 things could be affecting him, because I don't think it's the TV in his case.
While we're talking about sleep and technology, Dr. Dykin, the Harvard Business School professor Leslie Perlow has a new book out called Sleeping with Your Smartphone. And this astounding statistic, perhaps for many of our listeners, not so astounding. A survey of 1,600 managers, Professor Perlow found that 26%, so a quarter of the 1,600 managers surveyed, brought their smartphones to bed with them when it was time to hit the sack. Why? Well, according to this survey, the majority of those glued to their phones brought their devices to bed out of fear they might miss an important call or work email. 44% of these respondents who did bring it to bed claimed they brought their smartphones to bed because they used them only as alarms. What do you make of these findings?
Well, the alarm sounds pretty good, but when they fear they're going to miss something, as we've just talked about with the last caller, there's positive conditioning, then there's negative conditioning. And worrying about 24 hours a day, you can do it. And this is why insomnia is such a big problem. Our number one problem in regard to sleep disorders in the United States is you're worried about missing something. When you go to sleep, good sleep hygiene is really equivalent to feeling comfortable. And to me, it's a delicious nap, if you will. I look forward to it. So you got to get the right mindset, and you got to be able to escape, because the negative component of worrying about it and associating that with going to bed can really be a problem. Now, we had talked the last time we were here about the texting that the kids were doing. 77.5% some of the studies, the kids in some of the studies that had been done with the cell phones and the smartphones had difficulties falling asleep. And within that 1 hour period to up to 4 hour period after supposedly going to bed, they were still texting up to 3 to 4 different friends throughout the night, up to 30 times per night, and as such, getting up tired during the day with a higher risk of hyperactivity, anxiety, and poor performance in school. So sometimes it can be a positive thing, as we said, as alarms. And some of the people in this study for the adults said, I just check it within an hour before going to sleep. Makes me turn off the night, and then I brush my teeth, read my book, and go to sleep. And then an hour after waking up, I get back to work. So it's a pacifier for some people, but it can be poison for others. So what they recommend for the kids and maybe even the adults, generally the 1 hour electronic curfew, an hour before sleep, turn everything off, 20 minutes to finish up what you need for the day, 20 minutes to brush your teeth, 20 minutes to relax, read your book.
All right, let's go to Stan in Washburn. Thanks for waiting, Stan. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been on a sleep apnea machine, the CPAP, for about a year, year and a half now. And I've got, they told me I'd like a lower level, so it's not really, you know, it's not really bad, but I needed the CPAP machine. And I also got a little bit of restless leg going. And I haven't really noticed a lot of what I would call a quality sleep, and it seemed like I'm always tired in the afternoon. I ended up taking naps in the afternoon, and I just didn't know if there was a time limit about how long it should take to notice an improvement in my sleep.
Do you take a nap with the CPAP machine on?
Yes.
Good. Well, and that's the thing. There are 95 different categories we have to date. Sleep apnea is not the only thing. So, and a wise sage, one of my mentors from the Mayo Clinic, Dr. Peter Hari, once told me, he says, do not promise the patient a cure, because oftentimes improvement in cure is one thing. But we all have to agree that low oxygen is a bad thing. You can't live without oxygen. Haven't heard of anybody who's ever been able to live without oxygen. So a lot of people, as you just mentioned, oftentimes we like to see people who are worster. The worse apnea, you can tell a big difference. But a mild apnea, all you do is get your oxygen back up, and all of a sudden you don't have all those great rainbows you were promised, where life is, you know, reborn and you're running the 100-yard dash in the Olympics. So as you've implied, it's not unusual that people with mild apnea don't have that much to compare it to. But as you've also implied, if you've got significant apnea, even if it's mild, it's best to be treated, just like mild high blood pressure. And you may not actually evidence, and you know, might have got your hopes up. You know, you heard all these great things that you're going to be feeling so much better. And it is a thing strapped on your head, so a little bit of a double-edged sword. The second problem, though, is you want to make sure, though, that you really did get the deepest stage of sleep. We call it REM, rapid eye movement sleep, while you were in the supine, flat on your back position. Because that combination of deep stage of sleep, where the back of the throat is really floppy, and gravity, supine position, pulling back everything, that's oh so important. And my patient's still having a little bit of snoring, arousals with gasping, then we do a restudy in the laboratory to make sure they're at the right pressure. But, you know, it could be a million different things, but those are two to start with.
Okay, Stan, thank you very much for calling from Washburn. Coming close to the end of the hour, I wanted to mention this, an interesting research here. When you've been on this program before, Doctor, we've talked about the problems that couples can have when they sleep in the same bed with their partner. All kinds of complications can occur when you share a bed with someone. There's the Of course, moving around, especially if someone has restless leg syndrome, that's certainly a bother. But there's also just good old-fashioned sheet stealing, the differing bedtimes that come with that, and the room temperature preferences. Well, there's some new research that seems to run counter to that, that couples may get actually health benefits from sleeping in the same bed. I wonder if you can explain what that sort of mixed bag is. Why would you be able to sleep better with someone in the bed with all these possible complications?
Well, it's interesting, especially people who have been together for 50 years or more, people who have lived their entire lives. When one passes, it's not unusual, the blue or the black period, within that one-year period afterwards that the other one will pass. Sadness, emotional, I mean, the whole thing of becoming a unit with someone else. So that is an overriding thing. That's family, if you will, in my opinion. But like I mentioned with my family, if I'm snoring like a banshee, my son loves me to death, but he's not going to be able to stay in the room with me. And he's real happy I got the CPAP on my head. So those were some of the conflicting things that they've seen some of these studies. And they said if it's just sharing the sheets or too many sheets, get your own separate sheets. If it's loud snoring, have that primary disorder, and we've alluded to that, maybe obstructive apnea, treated so that you're not running your wife and your kids out of the house. So look at the obvious kind of disorders that may disrupt the sleep. But when they looked at this recent study, you do move around a little bit more, but without the other pathologies. When you adjust the environment accordingly, when you give a little leeway for bedtime and awakening time and temperature, et cetera, most people, even though they may move around more, are much more satisfied being with the ones they love.
Okay, let's try to squeeze in another call. Kathy is in Centerville with us. We have just a few minutes left. Kathy, what's on your mind?
Well, I missed the first 10 minutes of your program, but I'm really liking what you're talking about. I about the creepy legs. My grandma always used to call it creepy legs, so that's what we called it.
Restless legs, yep.
Yeah. But I noticed when I was on the Atkins diet about 5 years ago, we had the gal mentioned in the milk in her diet. When I was on Atkins, every single night I had creepy legs, every night. And as soon as I got off of it, you know, I got back into it. So, and, you know, cheese and meat is a big part of the Atkins diet. So, you know, maybe everybody's different, one with milk, and then mine, I needed more milk or less cheese.
Okay, let's get a comment on that. The Atkins diet, I believe, Doctor, isn't that high in protein, right?
Yeah.
Bacon and eggs and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, and right now I'm on the burn your fat diet, so I'm getting ready for a surgery, and I'm ketotic all the time. So, and I know it bothers me a bit more, and I don't know why that is, but the high protein diet, unique changes in diet, starvation, essentially what I'm doing, missing vitamins. There's an awful lot that may be associated with this. And if you make it simplistic, we do know that restless legs have been associated with a relative dopaminergic deficiency. And we know that to have the dopamine work normally as a neurotransmitter in our system that can help fight restless legs, a lot of foods, proteins, they're necessary for the body to function with cofactors and vitamins, et cetera. So good diet, good sleep, and air are all necessary to keep healthy.
Dr. Daikin, we've run out of time for this hour. We have a lot of emails, a lot of calls we didn't get to. Sorry if yours was one of those we didn't get to, but we hope to have the doctor. We certainly will have the doctor back in a few months' time. But in the meantime, we can give you the Sleep Disorders Center phone number, either in the restless leg syndrome. You can get in touch with them about this new study that's starting about restless legs syndrome or about other sleep questions. That Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa has a telephone, 319-356-3813, 319-356-3813. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Catherine Perkins, and Alex Hoyer. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. And Dr. Daikin, thank you so much for coming into our studio.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We'll see you again next time. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.